We'll come to order. Good morning, everyone. This is the last day to hear House bills. So we have a long list of bills that we need to tap in and tap out. So I'm going to do that first before there's a natural disaster.
I have time to go to the bathroom.
Yes, you do. No, actually, we have to have a quorum. Do we have a quorum officially?
Yeah.
Okay. All right.
Well, actually, you do.
Yeah. You can be excused.
No, that's
since you put that on the record.
Since you are now in the forum.
Oh.
Okay, I'm going to open a public hearing on House Bill 2577, and I'm closing the public hearing on House Bill 2577. I'm opening a public hearing on 2710, closing a public hearing on 2710. Opening a public hearing on House Bill 2712, closing the hearing on 2712. Opening a public hearing on 2715, closing the hearing on 2715. Opening a public hearing on House Bill 2965, closing a hearing on 2965. Opening a hearing on 2973, closing a hearing on 2973. Opening a hearing on 3048, closing a hearing on House Bill 3048. Opening a public hearing on House Bill 3086, closing the public hearing on House Bill 3086. Opening a public hearing on House Bill 3117, closing the public hearing on House Bill 3117. Opening a public hearing on 3148, closing a public hearing on 3148. Opening a public hearing on 3170, closing the hearing on 3170. Opening a public hearing on 3262, closing the hearing on 3262. Opening a public hearing on 3420, closing the hearing on 3420. Opening a public hearing on 3458, closing the hearing on 3458. Opening a public hearing on 3467, closing the hearing on 3467. Opening the public hearing on 3486, closing the hearing on 3486. Opening a hearing on 3528, closing the hearing on 3528. Opening a hearing on 3575, closing the hearing on 3575. Opening a public hearing on 2640, closing the hearing on 2640. Opening a hearing on 3392, closing the hearing on 3392. Opening a hearing on 3369, closing the hearing on 3369. Opening a hearing on 3322, closing the hearing on 3322. Opening a hearing on 3088, closing the hearing on 3088. Opening a hearing on 3543, closing the hearing on 3543. Opening a hearing on 2665, closing a hearing on 2665. Opening a hearing on 2785, closing the hearing on 2785. Opening a hearing on 3266, closing the hearing on 3266. Opening the hearing on 3276, closing the hearing on 3276. Opening a hearing on 3300, closing the hearing on 3300. Opening a hearing on 3316, closing a hearing on 3316. Opening a hearing on 3400, closing the hearing on 3400. Opening a hearing on 3464, closing the hearing 3464. Opening a hearing on 3491, closing the hearing on House Bill 3491. Opening a hearing on HJR 5, closing the hearing on HJR 5.
Okay, I'm going to stop there. Which we can now, we can just do all these.
11:30 the night before.
30 today. Mm-hmm. As long as it's after.
The remaining bills committee were posted late, so we will need to, at 1:30, go to hearing room H174 and tap these last ones in. We need a quorum to do that, so if anybody has to leave, if you could tell me, we will try to excuse everybody but the four that we need to tap the last in. Is that clear?
Yep.
Okay.
Madam Chair,
Representative Shaw.
I wanted to be in Wilsonville at 2 o'clock. Okay.
You can be excused.
Oh. Okay.
Thank you.
I'll cover for the good representative.
Can you vote for him too? We need to be there.
I'll go to work session.
Yeah. There is no work session on those bills. I want to make that clear.
Yet.
Okay. And next week we are only supposed to do work sessions except for permission from the speaker. So we will intend to do approximately 30 work sessions next week. Okay, I'm open. Okay, I'm going to open a work session on House Bill 3174 and have the staff refresh our memory.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. We just heard this bill a few days ago, on the 7th. This is the prompt pay bill. We have some dash two amendments as well as the Hannah Grove version of that. The dash two amendments specify the provisions do not apply to residential structures, allow state agencies or local government to make payments full within 7 days of the agency or government's approval, and it clarifies provisions that within the bill only applies to contracts negotiated or advertised after the effective date of the act. Thank you.
Okay, and we'll call forward Rick Thomas. Rick Thomas.
Thank you, Chair Close, members of the committee. For the record, Rick Thomas, Independent Electrical Contractors of Oregon. To be honest, actually, committee staff did an excellent job of going quickly through what the amendments do. You have the amendments in front of you in the Hand and Gross bill, but as was stated, we've taken into consideration a lot of different concerns from some of the local governments, addressed also CCB's issue, we believe, from earlier this week, seems like last week already, but in stating that before somebody enters the CCB process, they will have had a legal judgment through the means prescribed in the construction contract. So we think that that will actually save the CCB money in the long run. Also took out some references, not quite sure why they're in the bill, but to hazardous waste and allowing people to move off the job. But I think OSHA and others would take care of that for any contractor who wasn't prepared to. Representative Rosenbaum had brought up an excellent issue that was unintended in the bill relating to residential structures, and so we just pulled anything smaller than a fourplex out of the bill. There's a nice clean definition in statute already, so that's been taken care of, as well as again, another concern of local government, and that being that clarifying that it's after the bill is received by the owner as opposed to after the bill is sent. Unless there's any questions?
Questions from the committee? Guess there isn't. Thank you very much. Okay, we're in work session. Representative Kitts.
Madam Chair, I'd move House Bill 3174. I would move that we accept the dash one amendment to dash two amendment to House Bill 3174.
Representative Kitts has moved. It's Friday. Representative Kitts has moved the dash two amendment into House Bill 3174. Is there a discussion? Is there objection? Seeing none, so ordered.
Madam Chair.
Representative Kitts.
I would move House Bill 3174 as amended to the floor with a D-pass recommendation.
Representative Kitts moves House Bill 3174 as amended to the floor with a D-pass recommendation. Is there a discussion? Seeing none, the clerk will call the roll.
Aye.
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 Aye. Votes aye. Motion carries. And Representative Schaffer, I think this is a perfect bill for you to carry.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Okay, and we'll close the work session on 3174. Okay.
She came from over.
We're opening a work session on House Bill 3218, and I'd like to welcome former Senator Neil Bryant, who has come from over 100 miles away. Trust you had a good trip.
It was beautiful this morning.
And the staff will read the summary.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Members of the committee, House Bill 3218 exempts intermediary in tax-free exchange of property from licensure as construction contractor if they do not perform construction activities. There is a dash one amendment which is in your packet. I understand is a word tweak. We just got this morning.
Good morning.
Good morning. Thank you, Chair Close, members of the committee. My name is Neil Bryant. I'm an attorney in Bend, and I practiced here for about 30 years. I also had the privilege of serving in the Oregon State Senate for 8 years. I must say it's nice to be back in the building, but it was more comfortable being on the other side of the table with a gavel in my hand.
Sure.
But I'm delighted to be here. Last fall, I was approached by two clients, Summit Accommodators and Mount Hood Development Corp. These entities are individuals, or individuals own these entities that are basically accountants, and they do a process called 1031 exchanges, tax-free exchanges, which are recognized by the state of Oregon and the Internal Revenue Code. It's an opportunity for people who sell property to defer their capital gain tax if they invest it immediately within 180 days, usually, into other properties. And so they qualify with the IRS as qualified intermediaries pursuant to Section 1031 of the code. Sometimes the exchange involves property that is in the process of being improved, either remodeled, or you have to build something on it in order to prudently plan your tax deferral. And these are called construction exchanges, and these have been going on for many years. Last year, the CCB, the Contractors Board, said that if you do a construction exchanges, then the accommodator needs to get a contractor's license. Well, that didn't make much sense because, as I said, these people are accountants. They hold the title of the property. They hold the money because if the taxpayer takes control of the property or the money, then you get taxed the gain. And so I talked to the Construction Contractors Board about this, and I think they have an understanding that the public isn't jeopardized by this new exception under the code, and it's my understanding that they will not oppose what's proposed here. There's no risk to the public. The taxpayer, who's the ultimate buyer and consumer, controls the construction, but you have to go through this intermediary in order to defer the tax. So that's the purpose of what we have here. I've attached an example if you really want to get into the nitty-gritty of a 1031 construction exchange, and I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you very much, Senator. Questions? I guess she's explained it well. Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay, that completes our testimony on House Bill 3218. So I'm closing the public hearing, and I'll open a work session on House Bill 3218.
Madam Chair.
Representative Rosenbaum.
I'll move House Bill 3218 to the floor with the due pass recommendation. I'll move the -1 amendments to House Bill 3218.
Representative Rosenbaum moves the -1 amendment into House Bill 3218. Is there a discussion? Is there objection? Seeing none, so ordered. Representative Rosenbaum.
And now I'll move House Bill 3218 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Rosenbaum moves House Bill 3218 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there a discussion? Seeing none, the clerk will call the roll.
Aye.
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 Aye. Votes aye. Motion carries, and Representative Kitts will carry the bill. That was worth the long trip. Thank you. I'm opening a public hearing on House Bill 2304. And we'll call Ben Penhall of the Association of Oregon Counties and Ann Sees, Oregon Telecom. 2304. And we'll have the staff read the summary.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Members of the committee, House Bill 2304 simply establishes a state policy for broadband telecommunications services.
Madam Chair, committee members, for the record, my name is Bill Penhall, representing the Association of Oregon Counties, but today having somewhat of a different hat on, representing the Oregon Telecommunications Coordinating Council, which was established last session by Senate Bill 765 to look at the advancement of broadband telecommunications across the state, particularly emphasizing the needs in unserved and underserved communities. The council is made up of 19 members from across the state who have met over the past 18 months working on this issue and have developed a report to the legislature and have identified several bills, House Bill 2304 being one, that the council feels that the legislature should consider as a way of advancing the telecommunications infrastructure across the state. The material that you have coming around to you is information from the Telecommunications Coordinating Council, as well as information Ms. Steves is bringing today. I have included in that packet the creating legislation from the last session, Senate Bill 765, as well as the membership of the Telecommunications Coordinating Council. There are two bills in this committee that come from the council, and House Bill 2301 is one of those bills. There are amendments in the process, Madam Chair, and we don't have those this morning, and would have those later next week. But Ms. Steves will talk to you about the concept of the bill as we would see it amended. So with me today is Ann Steves. She is a community development director for the city of Coquille and emergency services coordinator in the Coos Bay area among several of the local emergency management services agencies. So I will turn the microphone over to Ms. Steves, and she can introduce herself and present testimony.
Thank you, Madam Chair and committee members. My name is Ann Steves. I am the Community Services Director for the City of Coquille, and I hope that you'll bear with me today. This is my first experience here. I'm here to talk to you today about House Bill 2304 coming through. I also serve on the Oregon Telecommunications Coordinating Council, and I do work in coordinating county emergency management. Even though I work for a city, I've been instrumental in coordinating a seven-county Homeland Security Summit in Southern Oregon. We have experienced some difficulties with our infrastructure for our 911 services and our public safety agencies in Southern Oregon. I brought the Register Guard article from January 4, 2003, that ODOT unfortunately cut a fiber optic cable in Camas Valley, which knocked our three counties out of long-distance telephone service, and we basically were isolated in our area. We are also working diligently with Oregon Emergency Management. I spoke to their director last night on the phone. He has been very supportive, Ken Murphy, of the work that we are doing in Southern Oregon, and the need through the council to ensure that all of the communities in Oregon have redundant communication systems. The day that this fiber cut occurred, we could not get money from the banks at the ATM. Your local pharmacist couldn't dispense prescription meds because they had no access to patient records or insurance companies. We are also working on interoperability and trying to deploy redundant communication systems for our public safety agencies so that they will be able to take some of the traffic off the radio. If you think of the day of the World Trade Center event, people picked up the telephone and they got a message that said, "I'm sorry, all circuits are busy. Please try your call again later." We don't want that to happen in Oregon. And we are making every provision to try to ensure, whether that's broadband fiber on the ground or in the air, whether that's wireless communications, whether that's satellite systems, that the state support a policy of ensuring that those redundant networks are in place for the public safety of all of our citizens. And so I would ask for your support. I believe you have the talking points before you, and I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Representative Rosenbaum.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Does this, I guess, question for either of you, does this bill, and I know that you said there will be amendments coming, but does it actually authorize anything to happen that's not currently possible under Oregon law?
At the moment, we are looking I'm sorry, Madam Chair and members. I am working with Ken Murphy, who is the Director of Oregon Emergency Management, and they are responsible for all of the emergency operations plans and 911 centers in the state. And we are interested in establishing a state agency, believe that will be OEM, but we're continuing that discussion, that will help us write rules, that will work with telecom companies, that will work with other providers, cell phone providers, et cetera, that will help us define the responsibilities for maintenance of those systems, for our ability to know what those resources are in time of a crisis. And I believe OEM likely will be the agency that we are interested in having in that role.
Representative Brewer.
You're doing very well, by the way.
Thank you. Okay.
Correct me if I'm wrong, but another little offshoot of this is the fact that it has a lot to do with economic development in southern and eastern Oregon particularly, because most firms will not locate that require fiber optics in an area where there isn't redundancy. So am I correct there?
Madam Chair and Representative, how do you pronounce your last name,
Girard.
Sir? Girard.
Good, that's good. Yeah.
I used to live in LeGrand and work with Terry Eccleston, and all of the consortia in the state that are members of our council believe that this also will support economic development. That is an attraction to our companies to know that there's broadband available for them. So you're absolutely right.
Thank you.
Madam Chair, if I may also comment on that, Representative Girard, there will be a bill before you next week, House Bill 2577, that speaks more specifically to the House Bill.
Some questions? Representative Kitts.
Yeah, thank you for being here today. This was pre-session filed at the request of the Joint Legislative Committee on Information Management and Technology for the Oregon Telecommunications Coordinating Council. The vice chair of that is opposed to this. Why?
Madam Chair, Representative Kitts, I was not aware of that. We met with the interim committee, I think, six times during the interim, reported to them on a regular basis. In November, reported to them, and I can't recall whether the vice chair was there or not, Representative Kitts, but the Joint Committee on Information Management and Technology accepted the recommendations and had them pre-session filed for us, and I was not aware of objections.
Thank you.
Other questions? Okay. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. And that is the testimony on House Bill 2304, so I'm going to close the public hearing on 2304 and open a work session on House Bill 2304. Okay. Discussion on this bill?
Madam Chair, I just had a question. That I thought the witnesses had said they had amendments coming on this bill next week.
You're correct, they do. So we do not need the work session. Close the work session on House Bill 2304. My apologies. Okay, we're going to go to House Bill 3313. I'm opening a public hearing. I'll call Paul Romaine and Gary Oxley.
Does anybody have a camera so we can take a picture of the two of us?
I don't think anyone would want that picture.
Good morning, Madam Chairman, members of the committee.
I'm sure some of you are very surprised to see us together on the same bill, supporting the same bill. For the record, Gary Oxley, Oxley & Associates, representing this morning Fred Meyer and Safeway Stores, who have asked that the House Bill 3313 be brought forward. What this bill does, very simply, relates to the Oregon Bottle Bill, and it allows a retailer to reject any container that is brought back to the store that is crushed beyond recognition. If you can't see the brand name or the barcode on the container, you would have the right to refuse to accept the container. The reason for that, very simply, is there are containers coming in today that we are required to accept currently under statute. And we accept those containers, give the consumer the nickel back. The distributors then have the option of rejecting those containers because they don't know if, in fact, they sell those products or not. And we don't fault the distributor for that. They shouldn't have to reclaim those containers if they're not a container, if they're not a product that they sell. So what we're trying to do here is basically save the retail side the nickel that they put back to the consumer's hands. This is a very small amount of money for those stores that redeem small amounts of containers. For the larger chain stores, this can be a significant amount of money over an annualized basis if you have 80 to 100 stores in your chain. That concludes my testimony on the bill. I'd be glad to answer any questions you might have.
Questions? Representative Shoffer and then Gerard.
Thank you. Representative Berger thinks you're all making a bunch of money on cans. You're not going to have anybody in the back room crushing these cans, are you?
Madam Chair, Representative, who makes the money on these containers is another debate for another bill, for another day. That's where you would see us probably not agreeing. But no, that would not happen, Representative.
All right.
Good question.
Thank you.
Representative Byrne.
Gary, correct me if I'm wrong, but all these little bottles, excuse me if you'd hold that up, they don't count as far as the deposit is concerned?
Madam Chair, Representative Gerard, no, they don't. Those are not refundable containers at this point.
Thank you.
So I guess my question is, with my three sons, if they keep crushing all these cans, they're going to lose a lot of money. You know how they put them through the hoops?
Madam Chair, as long as we can determine the product or the barcode can be read by the reverse vending machines, the cans, the containers would be accepted.
So you couldn't take them to the checkout like you do right now? I mean, if they're damaged, sometimes you can take them to some stores, so you go through the checkout line?
Correct. You could still, yeah, Madam Chairman, you could still do that. As long as you could see the brand name or the barcode, they would still be accepted.
Okay. Thank you. Any other questions? Okay. Thank you very much. And that concludes the testimony on House Bill 3313. I'm sorry. You wanted to testify?
Excuse me. Came all the way up here to be with you.
Trying to get you out of here by your 9 o'clock appointment.
Thank you. There you go. Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Paul Romain. I'm here with the Oregon Beer and Wine Distributors Association. We support the bill. A couple of questions are raised about stuff that comes in. Right now, a retailer does not have to take back any brand that they can't recognize as something that they sell. Neither does a distributor. Retailers, for public relations reasons, choose to take back a lot of stuff that they don't sell for whatever reason, just to have people come into their store. The bigger problem with this is the cross-border traffic. Really what you're finding in a lot of the over-redemption that we're running into is stuff coming in from out of state. And all these things are crushed out of state, and they bring them across border. You can't tell if it's an Oregon can or not. You can't tell what exactly it is, and we're getting a huge amount of over-redemption. This may aid in cutting back a little bit on that. It gives some more tools to the retailer. We support it. Thank you.
Paul, are you saying that some of this is intentional? I mean, is that what it looks like?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, there's a huge amount of intentional redemption of non-Oregon containers. We can tell you war stories that are almost border on the hysterical with people coming across. And we've had truckers call us out of California saying, when are you accepting redemption? I've got a load of bottles coming up, and they happen to be, this, in this case it was Henry Weinhardt bottles, which when they were sold in California or are sold in California, they had Oregon refund 5 cents on them. And they'd have a backhaul of a semi-load saying, when are you accepting deliveries? There's an enormous amount of stuff that comes over from Washington State.
And can I ask you, you know, on the top of the can, sometimes you'll have the stamp that says Washington or Oregon, you know, can. How do they, can you use that in any way, or do you have to use the barcode?
Madam Chair, the machines use the barcode. That makes it easier for the grocer. What the machine does is read the barcode. If the barcode says that it's a returnable container, and again, most containers, most barcodes just tell you the brand. I think Pepsi's the only one that has a specific barcode for the state of Oregon. But most barcodes, it's just for the machine. The lid is where most places, at least the national brands, put their deposit labeling on. Mm-hmm. And we have to take those back if we can recognize. If it says Oregon refund on there, we have to take it back.
I see. Okay. Other questions? Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Close the public hearing on House Bill 3313, and I'm going to open a work session on House Bill 3313.
Madam Chair.
Representative Gerard.
I move we move House Bill 3313 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Gerard moves House Bill 3313 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there a discussion? Seeing none, the clerk will call the roll.
Aye.
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 Aye. Is excused.
Aye.
Votes aye. Motion carries. And Representative Gerard, will you carry the vote?
Yes, ma'am.
Close the work session on House Bill 3313. Okay, I'm going to open a public hearing on House Bill 2881, and we'll have the staff read the summary, and I will call forward. John Schultz and Bob Shipwright.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and members of the committee. House Bill 2881 modifies exceptions to requirement that worker must notify employer, insurer, or self-insured employer of workers' compensation claim within 90 days after an accident. There are -1 amendments, which restore some language and delete others, but it specifies that failure to give notice of an injury or death bars a claim under this chapter unless this notice is given within 1 year after the date of the accident and the employer had knowledge of the injury or death, the worker died within 880 days after the date of the accident, or notice is given within 1 year of the accident and the worker is shown the cost for failure to give notice within 90 days after the accident. Thank you.
Good morning.
Good morning. Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm Bob Shipwright, Executive Secretary of the Oregon Building Trades Council. I guess this morning, however, I'm representing the Management Labor Advisory Council on Workers' Compensation. Megan's done an excellent job detailing what the bill does. Under current law, the problem we're trying to solve here, under current law, if a worker doesn't file a timely claim within 90 days of the injury, they are barred from entering the workers' comp system. It doesn't necessarily mean they didn't file the paperwork. They may have named the wrong insurance company. They may have worked hurt for 3 months. A lot of folks do that until they finally discover that they can't work. They may have filed the wrong type of claim. Frankly, the issue that brought this forward was an electrician friend of mine who filed an aggravation claim. They later found out it was a new injury. In the old days, if your shoulder hurt, that was good enough. Now, under the new rules, they kind of go through your shoulder, and if it's one muscle or a tendon that is different from the original claim, they may throw it out. And then oftentimes, a worker can file a claim against the wrong employer, particularly if they've worked for multiple employers and they've been barred from the system as well. I want to state that compensability is not the issue here. I'm talking about claims that are work-related, should be compensable, but because of the strictness of the current law, these folks are barred for a number of reasons that I've just described from filing those claims and having them paid. The language you're looking at was the law prior to 1995, so it's not new ground we're covering here. That was the current law prior to Senate Bill 369. key part of this is that it allows a worker who has missed the 90-day deadline to show good cause why they missed that for a variety of those reasons that I've described to you. The burden is on the worker to prove good cause. And what the whole intent of the bill is to provide a little bit of flexibility for people who may have tried to do the right thing, made a mistake through no fault of their own, and deserve to be in the workers' compensation system. So it opens the door a little bit. And this bill is coming to you with a unanimous vote from the Management Labor Advisory Committee. I guess kind of the mantra of that committee is we look at, the first thing we do is we look at fairness in the system, and I won't speak for the management side, but I think everyone looked at this and realized that we had a little problem here with fairness in the workers' compensation system. Stop there. Any questions?
Let's go to John, and then we'll take questions. Good morning.
Good morning, Madam Chair, members of the committee. I'm John Schultz. I'm the administrator of the Workers' Compensation Division, which is part of the Department of Consumer and Business Services. I'm here today to just speak to the amendments in 2881A. The proposed amendments, -1 amendments that you, I believe, have before you actually include a couple of problems that we discovered late yesterday afternoon. The first amendment on page 1 of the printed bill, it says lines 20 through 24. That should actually say lines 18 through 24. And then also there should be an addition in line 25 to delete notice is given within 1 year after the date of the accident and the, which is just redundant language. Once we leave that in up on lines 18 and 19. So there are two problems with the -1 amendments that I wanted to bring to your attention. We have raised those very late yesterday afternoon with legislative counsel, so he is now aware of these.
So we will be expecting a -2, is that correct?
That's correct, Madam. And I would be glad to answer any questions as well, if I may.
Questions?
Madam Chair.
Representative Rosenbaum.
Thank you. John, so does that amendment restore this language about the worker dying within 180 days after the accident? Because I was wondering why that had been deleted in this bill.
Madam Chair, Representative Rosenbaum, that's correct. That language would be restored.
Other questions? Okay. Well, thank you for this testimony, and I would just like to say that we appreciate your work on MWAC. We know when a bill comes, it's been approved by MWAC, that it's a good, solid bill, and that makes our work much easier. So thank you.
Thank you.
Okay, we'll close the public hearing on House Bill 2881 and intend to bring that back next week. And I'll open a public hearing on House Bill 3544. Call Daryl Fuller.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Daryl Fuller. I represent the Oregon Auditors Association, and we requested that House Bill 3544 be introduced. In the interest of time, I'll make my comments brief. It was discovered this morning that Bureau of Labor and Industries had concerns about the bill that I was unaware of, and I'm going to be happy to work with them on the concerns that they have. I'll briefly tell you why the bill is before your committee. A couple of my dealers in the last year or so faced the same set of circumstances where an employee was separated from employment from the dealership, and a number of our employees are paid through commissions, and so the dealership asked the employee, what do we owe you? We call it a book. We know what your book of work is. Tell us what we need to pay you. And the employee was paid what they were asked. Subsequent to that, the employee came back and said, actually, I figured out that you owe me more than I said you owed me. So here's the additional amount I want. And the employer and employee disputed that additional amount after the original amount was already paid. This ended up in court because of the disputed amount. And the court found in favor of the employee, said you do actually owe the additional money. The way the statute is currently instructed, if there is a constructed, if there is a disputed amount and the employee prevails, regardless of the amount of the dispute, the dispute literally could be a penny. Probably wouldn't end up in court, but there's no wiggle room in the statute. If there is a dispute of any amount and the employee prevails, the penalty that the employer pays is 30 days additional wages, plus interest, plus attorney's fees. What we intended to do in the bill is that if there is a disputed amount that ends up in court, that the maximum penalty, rather than 30 days additional wages, would be double the amount in dispute, plus attorney's fees. We believe that the punishment should fit the crime, and we believe that certainly in the case of the dealerships that I represented, that having them to pay an additional 30 days wages for an employee over a disputed amount that arose after the original amount requested was paid was a somewhat higher penalty than ought to be paid. Mr. Gardner from the Bureau of Labor Industries will indicate there are certainly circumstances where 30 days penalty wages is appropriate, and I'm not trying to dispute that, and we're going to try to get together and see if we can't paint a little less broad brush with the legislation, and would ask for your indulgence to bring it back in a work session with hopefully some amendments that everybody can agree to next time. And with that, I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Questions? Okay. Thank you very much. We will call Dan Gardner, our labor commissioner. And Christine Hammond, are you coming up as well?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Dan Gardner, Commissioner of the Bureau of Labor and Industries, and with me is Christine Hammond, who is the head of the Wage and Hour Division. I think in the interest of time for the committee, you know, Mr. Fuller and I, you have my written testimony of some of the concerns that I have about this particular bill and about the process involved with it. Rather than going through those concerns, just simply say that Mr. Fuller and I have decided that we'd sit down the early part of this next week and see if there is a way to take care of this particular situation with a surgical instrument other than a bulldozer. Anyway, I'll simply leave it at that.
Thank you, Commissioner, and we appreciate your willingness to work with Daryl and try to come up with a compromise.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Okay, so we're going to close the public hearing on House Bill 3544. And I'm going to open it. Excuse me? Open a public hearing on House Bill 2368 and have the staff read the summary.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Members of the committee, House Bill 2368 makes technical and administrative changes to cigarette and tobacco product taxes to facilitate administration and enforcement. It revamps penalties. It applies to cigarette tax and tobacco product tax reporting periods beginning on or after January 1st, 2004. The bill does have a subsequent referral to revenue. And we have a dash 2 and a dash 3 amendment before you, which the Department of Justice is going to speak to today. Thank you.
Okay, before we go into this bill committee, we have three of our members that are testifying on the same bill next door. So I want to allow time, and I know you want to hear the testimony. So when they call you, we will recess for 5 minutes so that you can go next door and then come back in and continue our testimony. So we will go forward until they call you. That's acceptable. Okay, Matt McCauley, Department of Justice. Victoria Clear, Department of Revenue. Thank you for being with us.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Matt McCauley. I'm a senior assistant attorney general of the Oregon Department of Justice Criminal Division with the Organized Crime Section, and I'm assigned currently to the Oregon Tobacco Compliance Task Force. This is Victoria Clear. She's the Tobacco Program Manager with the Department of Revenue. As you are all aware, the legislature created the Tobacco Compliance Task Force in the last biennium for the purpose of increasing compliance with Oregon's tobacco tax. The tobacco tax law and effectively deal with the associated crime that surrounds noncompliance. During the last year, the task force has been able to conduct a number of investigations that had aided us in determining the effectiveness of the current statutory scheme for enforcement. Based on our experience in the enforcement of the state's tobacco law, tax laws, we have made a number of additions and amendments to the statute to get the best enforcement structure possible. These changes make the law internally and externally consistent, more enforceable, easier to administer, and more clear for those whose businesses are affected. We've passed out some, hopefully it's been passed out, some information for you. There's a chart on page 2 and page 3. The Oregon's tax structure for tobacco was originally enacted back in the 60s and 70s. That would represent the chart on page 2. Page 3 represents the situation as we see it today. As you can gather from the graphic, we have quite a different ballgame that we're talking about. Essentially, the changes that we're talking about are all aimed at the following compliance problems. As it deals with cigarette tax, we have widespread direct sales of untaxed cigarettes to consumers. This would also include internet sales to consumers. We have, and all of those are untaxed. There's an insufficient penalty to deter criminal activity or conduct. And the latest tax increase on cigarettes that went into effect has made tax avoidance even more lucrative and tempting for those willing to do that. In House Bill 2368, we've aimed to try to clarify and strengthen the distributor licensing law, clarify and toughen crimes involving cigarettes, clarify the stamping law and those requirements, and require consumers to report and pay tax on direct purchases of untaxed cigarettes. And that's an attempt to capture mail order and internet business as well. As we look at other tobacco products, that's essentially chewing tobacco, snuff, cigars, loose leaf tobacco. The primary compliance problem is that distributors are not required to be licensed under the current scheme. They can if they choose to be, and if they don't choose to be, we have no ability to monitor them. I guess.
What is your time constraint this morning?
We're open for whatever the committee has.
Okay, we can continue to take your testimony, but I think some of the members would like to hear it. We would like to adjourn until 9 o'clock, or a recess until 9 o'clock. Is that agreeable to you?
That's agreeable.
Okay.
Thank you
very much. This is an important issue. We want to make sure people understand it. We will recess the hearing on House Bill 2368 until 9 o'clock and stand in recess. Thank you. Affairs will come back to order. I apologize, we went a little longer than 9 o'clock. Had some things to discuss. So we will call back our guests from the Department of Justice, Department of Revenue, Matt McCauley, Victoria Clear, and please continue.
All right. We have pretty much done a short overview of compliance problems and some general solutions that we provided for in the new bill regarding cigarette tax enforcement. So we have just begun talking about other tobacco products enforcement. And I misspoke. The current law does require licensure of other tobacco products distributors. But there is only a $1,000 fine would be the maximum penalty involved with not becoming licensed as an administrative matter, and that is such a small price to pay for all the distributors that we've encountered that they, the vast majority of distributors in Oregon for other tobacco products simply choose not to be licensed. So what we're asking for in this bill creates stiffer penalties for intentionally not becoming licensed and selling other tobacco products. One of the other problems then is the difficulty involved in collecting any kind of tax on other tobacco products. The bigger problem with other tobacco products is there's no tobacco tax stamp that gets affixed to any of those products, and the tax is therefore paid quarterly and subsequent to all the distributions. And in general, there are either no penalties or very, very few penalties involved with avoiding that tax.
Madam Chair.
Representative Gallegos. Can I just ask you to clarify what are the other tobacco products that don't? I mean, besides cigarettes, what are you talking about?
Chewing tobacco, snuff, loose leaf tobacco, pipe tobacco, roll your own, and cigars.
Thank you.
And so the solutions that we're have included in this bill would require retailers to have invoices that verify that the tax is paid or that they are liable for the tax. We would like to establish some crimes of illegal distribution of other tobacco products and clarify and strengthen the licensing requirements for other tobacco product distributors. For the committee's benefit, I'd like to tell you that we've worked on this bill as well as both of the amendments that are before the committee in a working group that included not only Department of Justice, Department of Revenue, but a working group that included representatives from all the major tobacco manufacturers in the country. And we were able to receive their input, and I'm not aware of any opposition to this bill or any of the amendments. And the Attorney General would like the committee to specifically know that the Dash 3 amendments are proposed by Philip Morris, and the Attorney General does support those amendments. They would dovetail very nicely with what we're proposing and specifically go a long way toward one of our major compliance problems, which are mail order or internet sales directly to consumers within the state, currently none of which are taxed. So we'd be open for questions at this time.
And Matt, did you, you probably gave this figure, but and maybe this is something Victoria will cover. Are you going to cover the amount of revenue lost, you know, what your guesstimate is?
We did not come up with an exact number on the cigarette tax. For OTP tax, we believe we're probably only capturing 20% to 30% of the tax.
I wanted to give Representative Gerard a chance to ask Matt a question.
And if I may, Chair Close, the and I don't want to talk against Victoria. We in talking about, at least in our funding discussions, I know the Department of Justice and Department of Revenue have told the legislature that cigarette tax loss is anywhere between $10 and $100 million annually. I know that's a real broad range, but as Victoria pointed out, that's the difficulty in assessing something that mainly is criminal activity.
I see. Representative Gerard.
I had a situation in my district where a cigarette retailer went down to California, made a bulk buy of product, and came back to Oregon with the product under the assumption that the distributor in California had paid the distributor tax in Oregon. Later to find out via a letter from the Revenue Department that he had not paid, or that the California wholesaler had not paid the distributor tax and that he was liable for it. Does this law change any part of that to enable Oregon to go after the true distributor rather than taxing the wholesaler, or I mean the retailer in Oregon?
Hey, Representative Gerard, it was, if I may ask a clarifying question, you said again this was a cigarette issue? Okay. Chair Close, Representative Gerard, I think the answer to that is what we are not changing, in fact, what we're clarifying is that the current statute puts the burden of the tax on for cigarettes on the consumer. And then anybody, the current law and the new bill firmly places the responsibility and the liability to pre-collect that tax upon the distributor. The difficulty, as you pointed out, is out-of-state distributors. In cigarettes, it's fairly easy to determine that because when the tax is paid, is basically pre-collected, the distributor is supposed to affix an Oregon tax stamp to the bottom of each package of cigarettes. So when a retailer receives cigarettes and they do not bear an Oregon tax stamp, those have not been taxed. And that's the easiest way for a retailer to discover that problem. We have the ability under certain circumstances, certainly to go against an Oregon licensed distributor who is out of state, and we involve our federal authorities in our task force when there is a crime that's occurred out of state that involves Oregon that we don't have any criminal jurisdiction for. And so we do have some ability to criminally do that. And by increasing the criminal penalties in the bill, we would have an even greater ability to affect the illegal transfer of cigarettes.
Okay, thank you.
Other questions?
Hey,
Victoria.
Yeah.
Did you want to give a presentation?
No, I have nothing. I was here to answer any questions that the committee may have.
Okay, I guess there's the dash twos and the dash threes. So just to be clear, we need them both in the bill. Is that correct?
That is correct.
And I wonder if you can just hit the highlights of the amendment. I know you you have some definitions. You have some things about publishing the list of names. Do you want to just give us the main provisions of these amendments?
Oh, you don't have one yet. And Chair Close, are you referring to the dash two amendments?
I'm looking at the dash twos right now, yes.
Okay.
And if you could give us a highlight.
Essentially, these were changes that as we got back in our work group with the tobacco manufacturers, the Department of Revenue, Department of Justice, we realized that our initial drafting of the bill had left unclear a few things, and essentially that's what dash two amendments are these clarifying, adding a few words here and there that we thought were stronger or were more clear. I don't really believe there's much that is substantive that appears in the dash two amendments.
Well, I guess there's quite a bit about appeal rights and appealing this, and I.
Well, I think I believe that the effort of the Department of Revenue, and certainly Victoria can talk to this, was to make the appeal process easier and to have it dovetail into the existing tax structure for appeals in the current tax system. Since that is the way, this is a taxing issue, and so anything that's dealing with an administrative part of the enforcement of the tobacco tax would go through on appeal through the Department of Revenue's already existing appeal process, and I believe that's what these amendments deal with.
Okay. All right. Questions? Yes, we have none. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
Okay, that completes those who have signed up to testify on this bill. Marshall? I'm closing the public hearing on House Bill 2368, and I'm going to open a work session on House Bill 2368. Committee, this is a bill that has a subsequent referral to revenue. It's early. And so our job here is initially to, approve the policy and approve the amendment. So, discussion, Representative Kitts.
Oh, I'm sorry, I don't have discussion.
Okay, if you wish to make a motion.
Only if they wish not to discuss. Madam Chair, I would move that we accept the drafted agenda dash 2 and 4 at the same time. Or
dash 3 and dash 2.
Okay.
We don't know what happened to the dash 1.
Who needs it? The dash 2 and 3, then? Amendments to 2368 be accepted.
Okay, Representative Kitts moves the dash, the dash 2 and dash 3 amendment in the House Bill 2368. Is there discussion? Is there objection? Seeing none, so ordered.
Madam Chair, I would move that House Bill 2368 be moved to, was it rules?
Revenue,
with the due pass recommendation as amended.
Representative Kitts moves House Bill 2368 as amended to the House Committee on Revenue with a due pass recommendation. Is there discussion? Okay, seeing none, the clerk will call the roll.
Aye.
Representative
Gerard? Aye.
Representative Merkley?
Aye.
Representative
Joplin?
Aye.
Representative
Kitt?
Aye.
Representative Rosenbaum? Aye. Chair Close? Both aye. Motion carries, and bill moves to revenue. Thank you very much. Okay, I'm going to open a, and I'm going to, let's see, is that automatically close the hearing?
Yeah.
It's the work session. House Bill 2555, we will open a public hearing and call forward Sandy Friend and Bill Cross and have the staff read the summary.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Members of the committee, House Bill 2555 creates the Oregon Board of Interior Design. It requires a person registered with the board to practice as registered interior designer. Poses a civil penalty up to $5,000 for violation and takes effect on the 91st day following adjournment signing die. And it does have a subsequent referral to Ways and Means. Thank you. There are some dash ones we just got this morning that should be distributed.
Okay.
Some amendments.
Hey, Bill and Sandy.
Good morning, Madam Chair.
Good morning.
Good morning, representatives. My name is Sandra Friend. I'm from Southern Oregon. I'm the legislative chair of a coalition of approximately 700 interior designers. I have practiced interior design and lighting design for the past 25 years. My work has included healthcare, senior housing, corporate, educational, and residential projects. And in doing all of this work, the primary requirement is a working knowledge of fire and life safety codes, national, state, and local building codes and standards, accessibility and air quality and ergonomic issues, standards for the disabled, and quality and quantity of lighting. The basis for this interior design registration bill is the fact that the design of interior spaces affects the health, safety, and welfare of the public. The Oregon consumer has no way to identify qualified interior designers who have comprehensive professional training, technical knowledge, and competencies to design projects that require adherence to fire and life safety codes, building codes, products that meet critical flame spread, smoke, and toxicity ratings. The registration program described in HB 2555 and similar to those statutes in 24 other states and jurisdictions will establish standards of minimum competency, standards for ethical business practice, and a means by which consumers may address grievances. The Interior Design Registration Act is not a practice act. It will not prevent anyone from providing interior design services, nor would interior designers be permitted to engage in the design of load-bearing or seismic work. It would grandfather architects as well as individuals with at least 8 years of substantial interior design experience and knowledge of state building code and regulations. HB 2555 will reduce the risk to public health and safety and provide a measure of protection from improper specification, leaving consumers at risk in situations where they may be exposed to toxic off-gassing from building materials, glues, paints, where they may attend functions or have offices in spaces where windows, wall, and floor coverings do not have acceptable smoke and flame ratings, where they need to exit from public buildings where exit corridors may not have wall covering that is properly rated for flame retardancy. A perfect example of how a qualified or an unqualified interior designer may jeopardize public safety is a story told to me by a Portland designer where they were called in as a follow-up designer or as a second designer. And the client was attempting to convert a basement into a bedroom for a college student who was coming home to live for a while. The design of the space had been proceeding, and for some reason it had not been satisfactory. However, the designer never told the homeowner that the space was totally unsatisfactory for this use because the only window in the space was too small for this college student to exit had she needed to do that. So it would not have met building codes, and they would have gone ahead, planned the space, and either not known that it was not satisfactory or had a tragedy occur and discovered it that way. So I guess in conclusion I would say to you that HB 2555 would enable consumers to determine which interior designers are qualified to design safe interior spaces, and it would also enable building officials to recognize construction documents and specifications from designers qualified based on education, experience, and examination to plan safe interior spaces. Thank you.
Madam Chair, committee members, my name is Bill Cross, and I'm here today representing the Oregon Coalition for Professional Interior Design. And I just wanted to take a quick minute to walk you through the Dash 1 amendments, because basically they're a replacement to the original bill. We had looked at creating a semi-independent board to administer this program, and because of the situation facing Oregon right now, that is not a very feasible direction to pursue. We've been meeting with the Building Codes Division, who has helped prepare this draft under the basis of adopting rules to implement a basic registration program using the education and experience criteria that are used, frankly, in conjunction with the National Council for Interior Design Qualification, and using then their examination, which is recognized in the 24 other states that do have either title or practice acts with respect to interior designers. The second section of the bill basically defines interior design, and that is definition model language based on some of the language used in the 24 other states. And then by rule, we're basically asking the Department of Consumer Business Affairs, Business Services, to implement the rules for the registration. It then allows, on page 3, you'll see that it allows the department to charge $250 for a two-year registration, which would cover the cost then of the program, so it would be self-sufficient. And Section 5 has the grandfathering provisions, which were in the original bill, which allow architects and those with 8 years of experience to qualify to become registered. In Section 3, that also was in the original bill, but that's the section that states that this is not a practice act, that anyone can continue doing what they're doing now, that all we're doing is reserving the title Registered Interior Design for those individuals who qualify through the experience, education, and examination requirements set out in the bill. The bill would then go into effect July 1. The registration elements would go into effect July 1. And all the other portions of the original bill, in terms of developing standards of conduct, providing consumer mediation, some of those provisions have been deleted from the bill so that it is simply a registration program. I'd be happy to answer any questions you have.
Questions? Sam Merkley.
Thank you, Madam Chair. In Section 6, it says design documents prepared by registered interior designer, shall be accepted for filing by state or local building official. Doesn't this create a distinction doesn't that make this a practice act, that those who are registered can in fact submit plans and those who are not registered cannot?
Madam Chair, Representative Merkley, no, it doesn't, in that anybody right now in Oregon can submit design documents or plans for permitting purposes, and they don't have to be design professionals. However, this would identify the individual as someone, as an interior designer, who has code knowledge and background, which would help facilitate that the recognition from the building official's perspective.
I have a follow-up question, Madam Chair.
Follow-up.
My understanding is that Oregon is on the verge of adopting a new building code that would change that assumption that anyone can submit plans. Is that correct?
Madam Chair, Representative Merkley, the international building code, which is possibly the model code that they will use to replace our current building code, which might get adopted in 2004, has a provision recognizing a registered or state registered design professionals. And whether Oregon will adopt that in its entirety or continue to have amendments like we do now in Oregon, which allow virtually anybody to submit a plan and they can do it on a napkin, yet to be determined. But if in fact we were to adopt that model language as it is, then this would ensure that an interior designer who has been registered would be able to submit those plans.
Thank you.
Other questions? Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you. I call Carol Halford, Board of Architect Examiners, and Cindy Robert and John Baker, who are with the American Institute of Architects. Good morning.
Good morning, Chair Close, members of the committee. My name is Carol Halford. I'm the administrator of the Oregon Board of Architect Examiners. A board member was scheduled to appear before you today but was unable to do so, so you're stuck with me today. The Architect Board is in opposition to this bill. You should have a copy of a letter, a brochure, and a worksheet outlining all the details of the board's opposition. And I'll give brief testimony about some of the key points in that letter. I haven't seen the amendments. Listening to what they had to say, I don't think it changes much from my testimony. The proponents of this bill say that this is a title act only to use the title of registered interior designer. However, the bill goes into detail to define what the practice of interior design is, including a requirement to sign and date all drawings, plans, specifications, and reports, and allowing the building officials to accept those. In addition, there are provisions for disciplinary action based on incompetent or grossly negligent interior design services, although those aren't defined in the original bill. The board believes these parts of the bill sound more like a practice act than a title act. In fact, even the bill summary states registration is required before a person can practice. However, in the end, use of the title is voluntary, and there's no statement in the bill to explain how registration to use that title protects the public. The other major item of concern to the board is in several definitions relating to what the practice of interior design is. It includes work that does not materially affect building structures, and then the bill gives examples such as ceiling systems, but those do affect a building structural system by imposing vertical and lateral loads to the structural element that support them, and this would also include a seismic element as well, which must be embraced in Oregon buildings. This bill does not include a training and education requirement to cover seismic concern. In addition, there's a definition of the practice of architecture and the practice of engineering. Those definitions should not be reworded here, but rather referred to the Individual Practice Acts for engineers and for architects. Because this bill does not protect the public, it creates a new layer of bureaucracy to do so, and it changes the definition of the practice of architecture. This board encourages the committee to oppose House Bill 2555. That concludes my testimony, unless you have any questions of me. Thank you.
Cheryl, have you seen the Dash 1 amendment?
I have not.
You have. Okay. Cindy Robert.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Cindy Robert. I represent the American Institute of Architects. With me today is John Baker. He's on the board for for AIA Oregon and also for the regional chapter of AIA, and he happens to be an attorney, so he's just by definition much smarter than I am, but I'll start anyway. We basically have three issues with this, and we did just get the amendments this morning, which is understandable, and everyone's in a crunch right now, but we'll do the best we can based on what we have in front of us. I have three issues here. First of all is with the definitions. Mr. Cross told you as he was sitting here that they are only interested in title registration, which he said, correctly, deals with exam, experience, and education. We think this bill goes much further than that, in that it has definitions in it that don't have to do with exams, experience, or education. And those definitions muddle up other parts, as Carol just pointed out, in architecture and engineering code. On top of that, there are certain provisions like the non-seismic interior elements, saying that an interior designer will not deal with non-seismic interior elements, and yet we don't know how they're supposed to judge whether something is a seismic element or not. They're not trained in seismic element. And so they sign a document, send it in, say it didn't have seismic issues in it, but how would they know? And then later on in the bill, it takes away any liability that they may have for improperly making that decision. That's one of the problems. There's several of them in the definitions, but my understanding is that we don't need to get into that yet. The other issue is the oversight. The proponents of the bill talked a little bit about how they needed this to make sure that there was protection of the public and that only people with the right qualifications were calling themselves interior designers, and that they also wanted to uphold the ethics of the interior designer. Yet there's no board established here that does any oversight of any of those things. There's simply a registration fee, an exam, and number provided. There's no oversight here. There's no oversight of the ethics of the interior designer who's registered. There's no discipline of the interior designer for doing more than what this bill provides that they should do. My final concern is just the why. I'm not sure at this point that I've seen compelling evidence as to why we should be establishing a new regulatory body or adding to a regulatory body's duties based on interior design for reasons that I'm not sure have been proven at this point in time. I'd be happy to answer questions, but for expediency, perhaps we'll move to John and he can get into the details.
Let's go to John.
Thank you, Chairman Close, members of the committee. My name is John Baker. I'm the Vice President of Legislative Affairs for AIA Oregon. I'm also on the National Board of the American Institute of Architects, and I'm on the Licensing Committee and the Chairman of the Licensing Committee for the National on the Board of Architects. I am here in my capacity as a representative of AIA Oregon, and would like to speak against this bill in this state, but I'd like to preference the remark with the fact that the architectural community recognizes that interior designers perform a very important function in the design and construction of good buildings and good spaces in Oregon, and that very many interior designers are extremely skilled and very well trained and skilled, and many of them are even architects practicing solely as interior designers. And that the art and science of interior design are important aspects in the design and construction industry. Architects also are inclined to recognize that that truly qualified interior designers need to be able to identify themselves, and that there should be some way to identify them. Certainly within the practice of architecture, the architects would want to identify them. Be that as it may, We have a system in Oregon already by which the practice of architecture and the practice of engineering are already defined, and they are regulated to the extent that a person is not authorized to practice in those spheres, or at least to a certain extent, without the requisite license, which cannot be obtained until one has shown that they have a certain broad education and training and experience to go with it and pass an examination showing that they have broad experience and are able to make certain determinations with respect to how buildings should be designed and what should be safe in a building and what is appropriate with the public interest in mind. And in fact, architects are trained to some degree in engineering, at least to the extent that the architect knows when the architect is qualified to do the engineering or not, has enough of that broad experience to be able to say when a building needs special seismic design and when the architect himself or herself is not qualified to do that seismic design and would have to bring in another design professional. The definition of interior design that is offered here by the interior designers is all activities that are included within the definition of the practice of architecture. They are all part of the practice of architecture. Currently, interior designers can work within this realm and do exactly the services that have been provided, depending upon whether the needs are go to the life safety issues that would put it within the regulation of requiring an architect's participation or not, based upon the definition of what is regulated under the Architecture Practice Act and what is not regulated.
John, let me just clarify. seems to me that the problem here is you've got people who get a four-year degree in interior design. They're trying to protect their profession from those that don't have the four-year degree and haven't taken the coursework. You've talked about how architects have to take a test and be certified and licensed to protect themselves from people who are call themselves designers that draw houses and buildings but don't have degrees. So how do interior designers protect themselves, their profession then, if they're not allowed to have some sort of certification or a board that regulates them?
I think that the architects or the interior designers should be establishing, should set standards for themselves. We support that they set standards for themselves. I think that we're even prepared to say that we would support that they set governmental regulatory standards for themselves with respect to a true registration act. The AIA's objections to this particular bill on this particular date is that it interferes with substantially in a legislative way with what are the regulated practices of architecture and engineering, and it interferes with them in a way that it tends to refine and redefine them, and that any definition of the practice of architecture or the practice of engineering in this kind of bill, which is only a registration act, can do nothing but cause trouble elsewhere with respect to how these practices will work and how these practices would work together.
And are you, does that include the dash ones in what you're saying?
Yes, Chairman Close. I have had an opportunity to look over at very short order the dash one amendments and the changes there. The things that the AIA objects to are still in the bill, which would go to attempting to define the practice of interior design, which I think Cindy Roberts' comment that it shouldn't be necessary to define the practice. What we should be defining, if it's truly a registration act, is what are the qualifications and what is the experience that these people have that sets them apart. And we would support that fully because we believe there are such people that have that kind of experience and do deserve to be set apart from other people that are practicing in that profession or purport to be.
Okay. I think in the interest of time, that presents the argument pretty well. So what I would like to do at this point is call forward Mark Long of Building Codes Division and get his input on this matter. Thank you very much for your testimony.
Morning, Chair Close, members of the committee. For the record, Mark Long, Administrator of Building Codes. We received the Dash 1 amendments on House Bill 2555 this morning. Just to give you a little bit of background, the division has worked with the proponents of the bill on developing a registration system, and we're comfortable with the registration system. I find myself in an awkward spot because I have two of my stakeholders I work with, one saying that we have a scoping problem and another saying that we don't. And frankly, I'm not clear on what Dash 1 would do to existing engineer architects law and still provide this. So what I would like to do, if it's the committee's pleasure, is have the opportunity to work with the folks on this. I will commit to making this one of our top priorities for next week, Monday or Tuesday, and come back to the committee and give you my 2 cents worth on how this might impact existing law and kind of the questions that were brought forward today.
Okay, I appreciate that, Mark. I think we will take you up on that. We would like you to, I would direct the drafters of the bill and also the architects to work with Mark, and we would like to have something back late next week if we could.
Sure.
Okay. Questions, Representative Merkley.
Thank you, Madam Chair. This question that I raised about the adoption of a new code and how that would affect people who are not registered, when you hold these discussions, could that be clarified, and could you clarify that to the committee when you come back?
Sure. Chair Close, Representative Murphy. I'd be happy to, as well as we were taking notes on the various issues, and I'll get the folks together, and we'll dive into the statutes and the rules and see what we can come back with. Okay?
Other questions? Thank you very much.
Yeah.
I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 2555. And I'm going to open a public hearing on House Bill 2433 and close a public hearing on House Bill 2433. And I'm going to open a public hearing on House Bill 3541 and close a public hearing on House Bill 3541. Committee, you notice the agenda has two items left that cannot be heard until after 11:15 and 1:30. So, again, we will, four of us will need to be in room 174 to be able to tap those bills in after 1:30. So, is there anything else for the good of the committee?
You mentioned Tuesday night.
Oh.
Yes. Committee, in the interest of trying to get through the bills that we do have on this long tap-tap list, we plan to have a hearing Tuesday again at night, 6:30 to 8:30 in this room. Representative Shoffler.
And that being said, thank you, Madam Chair. You know, since time is of the essence and so valuable, I really, and I said this in my other committee too, we had a time card punch clock in here. There might be some people being docked and pay or even fired if I were the boss. I want people, I'm requesting gently that we all be on time for these meetings. 5 minutes, 10 minutes, 15 minutes, I find it unacceptable. Now maybe that's the way it's always been around here, and maybe that's the way it's always going to be, but I really am punctual, and I want other people to be punctual too. Thank you, Madam Chair, for indulging me.
Well, Representative Shoffler, you have every right to make that comment since you are always the first one in the hearing room. So we are, you are an inspiration to us.
Thank you.
For the
record, Representative Gerard.
Hold it, Madam Chair.
Representative Gerard was on time. Representative Gerard walked in with Shoffler this morning, I do believe.
Uh-huh.
One step ahead.
We're not keeping roll, but we appreciate your comments, and we will make every attempt to meet the schedule. Thank you. Anything else for the good of the committee? Hearing none, we are adjourned.